When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hello, Lucy.
Hi, Alex. How are you?
I'm all right. I'm packing a suitcase, actually.
You're always packing a suitcase. I know. Where are you going now?
I'm going to Cambridge. I'm going to the Cambridge Literary Festival,
lovely,
which is on this coming weekend, if you're listening, as it were, in real time, where I'm going to be interviewing all sorts of people, including Hugh Bonneville.
Fantastic. Paddington's dad, I want to say, though that's a weird thing to say.
No, Paddington's dad, the patriarch of Downton Abbey, and also Ian Fletcher in W1A,
yes,
one of my favourites. I will be on the stage with him, with Nadia Hussein, with Francis Bufford and Joe Browning Rowe, with Abby Morgan, with Carmela Shamsie.
Wow.
All going on. And I hope to track down the as yet unknown winner of the Bailey Gifford Prize. By the time you, the listeners, hear this, you probably will know because it's imminent, but I will be attempting to find them. They will be appearing at the festival and I am going to try to track them down, have a chat with them that you'll hear next week. So it's a busy weekend.
Brilliant. That does sound very busy. I was going to ask you, Alex, if you wanted to know the answer to the question, why should we be glad to be alive? You can say no if you want. Just be like, no, I'm not bothered.
I actually would like to know the answer to that question, Lucy. Do you have it?
Well, I've got one answer to it, it turns out, in the TLS this week. One of the answers is beauty, because there's a review of a couple of books about beauty, and one of them is saying that this is a reason to be glad to be alive. And also talking a lot about YOLO, which is, I'm sorry for saying it like that, you only live once. And our reviewer, Kieran Settier, who teaches philosophy at MIT and has got a book out and, you know, knows whereof he speaks, he says, this is great, but can I put in a word for the planners? He makes a case for sucking the marrow out of life on a tentative schedule. Isn't that nice?
Unpack that a little bit for me.
What he means is, because I think the first book is sort of about pursuit of beauty and you kind of throw yourself at it. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
And he's saying, well, you can throw yourself at it, but that's not the only way.
Yes, somebody like me might say, well, how do you know which shoes to take if you've just to throw yourself into beauty? You know, and the spontaneous is all very well, but it does still have to be planned for.
Well, yeah, exactly. That's what he says. Sucking the marrow out of life on a tentative schedule.
You put in place things that you might want to do, but you don't get sidetracked from the possibility of just changing plans. You're not too rigid about it, perhaps.
Yes, he doesn't exactly say that, but I think, yes. I think he's saying that there's lots of routes to it. You get there how you get there. And he says, if beauty is not the only answer to the question, it's a good one. And it isn't necessarily the only answer, he says, but it's a good answer. So there you are. You're welcome. And the other amazing thing we have is we have a translation by Margaret Yule Costa of the last ever newspaper column by Javier Marias for El País. His 939th column for them. I had to check that because it just seems extraordinary, doesn't
it? That slightly puts one's own ideas of productivity to shame, doesn't it?
It really does.
I mean,
it's a lovely piece about translation, about translating, you know, works of literature and how he misses doing it. I mean, partly he misses doing it because he had to stop because it's very badly paid. And as we all know, translators are, you know, badly paid and not enough acknowledged.
Yes, unsung heroes.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That was his last ever column. So it's in the paper this week.
Oh, that is a wonderful thing to read. Thank you very much for that preview. We have some other wonderful gems, we hope, in this podcast, because coming up on this week's show, our French editor, Russell Williams, will be joining us to talk about Emmanuel Carrère's book, which centers on the long and detailed trial in the wake of the Bataclan attacks in Paris. And we'll also be looking at TLS contributors' recommendations of their books of the year.
But first, 7 years ago, France endured a night of multiple terrorist attacks centered around the Bataclan concert hall in Paris. 131 people died and hundreds were wounded. The terrorists also targeted the Stade de France in the north of the city and cafes and bars where people were eating and drinking on the terrasse on a Friday night. The trial of those involved in the attacks took place last year, and the novelist Emmanuel Carrère attended them, wrote about them for the magazine L'Obs, and has now published these columns in a new book. Russell Williams, our French editor, has written about this book for us and is here to talk us through it. Russell, many thanks for joining us. You're actually in Indiana, aren't you? Far away from home.
I am a long way from home, and the longer I spend here, the further away from home it feels.
That sounds rather poignant. I know we will be chatting, but I think you're missing European coffee.
I am. I'm fueled by about 20 cups of really, really weak American coffee every day. I'm drinking it like water at the moment.
Gosh, that cannot be good for you long term.
You're on university business at a liberal arts college, and I think you said it puts you in mind of a Donna Tartt novel.
Well, yes, or a Bret Easton Ellis novel, or even White Noise by Don DeLillo, one of these remote colleges in the middle of the Midwest, in the middle of nowhere, where there's very little else apart from a big sprawling campus with countryside all around. You can see how somebody like Don DeLillo would be inspired to write White Noise after spending any time in a very bizarre place such as this.
I'm thinking of Jane Smiley as well. One of her books is set in that sort of campus, isn't it? But all I will say is, Russell, if anybody says come into the woods, we're having a bit of a ritual, don't go.
Oh yeah,
we need you.
Do it.
I'm desperate for that kind of invitation, frankly, Alex.
But you're joining us with your French editor's hat on, as it were, because this book, Emmanuel Carrère, is obviously a very kind of great, very established writer in France. We'll talk about him and why he's doing it in a minute. But first of all, to talk about the trial itself. So it's called V13, isn't it? Because the attacks took place on a Friday the 13th. And the trial, the impression I got from your piece is that it was a sort of public spectacle, but not a circus. It was kind of well managed, and they thought about how the process was going to happen, and they tried to be organized and respectful. Does that make sense?
I think it does. Obviously, we're dealing with a hugely traumatic event, but this trial, yes, it was the trial of those who were accused of participating and helping the massacre to take place. The participants who actually were responsible for doing the bombing and the shooting themselves are either, you know, missing or presumed dead in the attack. I think the actual trial, as you say, Lucy, was particularly well managed. The French legal system were very careful of it not becoming a spectacle in the truest sense of the word. It was very much a grinding, legal, bureaucratic performance that didn't glamorize or didn't sensationalize the very, very awful, tragic details of what happened on that night in February. But it was also a trial that was stage managed or constructed in such a way that the focus of it was testimony of the very many people who were victims or families of victims or survivors of what happened on that awful night.
I mean, trials such as that, after, you know, exceptionally traumatic and violent events, do often seem to function as a sort of social catharsis in a way. They sort of are about hearing those stories and almost an act of remembrance. Did the trials feel like that, I wonder?
I think it did. I think the most important takeaway from the trial has been the opportunity that the survivors and the families of survivors had to speak and to have their testimonies validated, listened to, performed in public. I teach a bit of Greek theatre, and catharsis kind of always feels a little bit kind of performative and a little bit extreme. And I think one of the kind of interesting textures of this case was the bureaucratic stage on which these testimonies were performed. It was very polite, but everybody was given the opportunity to speak. The presiding judge was, you know, very respectfully listening to everything that the survivors and their families had to say. I think it's important to remember here that there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of testimonies. This was a trial that ran for months. And actually being part of this trial, either reporting it or being part of the legal team or being an interested family member who was listening to this case, meant that you were signing up for weeks and weeks and weeks of grisly detail and heartbreaking anecdotes and accounts of the trial. In many ways, it's also an act of a feat of endurance for all of the people who were associated with it too.
Mm. And we might think at first glance that Emmanuel Carrère would be an unusual choice of author to write about this in one way, wouldn't we, in terms of some of the books you've read. Can you kind of lay out in some ways why you would have thought, well, hang on, why is he doing it?
Well, Emmanuel Carrère is a writer who is not adverse to sensation. He's best known as a memoirist. And Emmanuel Carrère is somebody that generally puts himself at the centre of whatever he's writing about. You know, he's written accounts of a murder case back in the 90s. He's written about the dissident Russian writer Limonov. He's written about the beginnings of early Christianity. He's written about the American sci-fi writer Philip K. Dick. But actually what you get in all of these novels, you get a real close interrogation of Emmanuel Carrère himself. And you get, you know, a real kind of, you know, he's been accused of being extremely narcissistic and navel-gazing. And I think with most of his work, if you get a picture of anything, you know, whether it's about the early Christian church or a Russian dissident writer, you actually get a lot of details about Emmanuel Carrère and his own kind of personal trajectory here. And he doesn't shy away from, you know, there's loads of sex in your typical Carrère novel. There's a personal intimacy in his books that is kind of fascinating. But then you think, well, is he really the right guy to be sharing the space of this? But actually, I think he is.
His last book, Yoga, which was a great success, wasn't it, and acclaimed, was totally about him, and it was about his relationships and a breakdown and all of that. I mean, it was more about him almost than any of the others, wasn't it? So why, if he is present in his books, as we say, sometimes front and center, so why is he the right person then?
I think he's a good enough writer and a mature enough writer and a sophisticated enough writer to actually have the taste and the grace to make this case, you know, not about him. I think like many of us who were living in Paris at the time of the November the 15th attacks, you know, he was bowled over by the magnitude of the atrocity. Personally, I was living a mile away from the Bataclan when it happened. I was living at the same time about 300 meters away from one of the cafes that was attacked. And, you know, it was a hugely poignant kind of moment. And I think there's also a kind of working through of the case for Emmanuel Carrère as well, a working through of the atrocity. He's also trying to understand what's going on, but he's doing so in a respectful manner. So he's respectful enough to kind of absent himself from the text. You know, he's written enough journalism in his career, which we forget. You know, he started off as somebody who did a lot of reporting, even court reporting. So he's experienced enough to kind of to make this not about him.
But I guess with narratives of this kind, I mean, with the events that occurred, there is always that sense of them having a greater resonance, a resonance more widely. When there's an attack on a city, it came to feel like an attack on much more than just those places and those people. And I wonder how he addressed that in the book, if he does.
The reason I like Emmanuel Carrère is he's not concerned really with the political or social significance of this case. He's interested in the human stories. And I think one of the things that Carrère does very well in many of his books is focus on small details and actually tease out if there is a kind of social meaning or a political meaning. It comes through in the small details, in the gestures. in what we learn about the last moments of some of the victims of the shooting, of what we learn about how they prepared to get ready for a Friday night out at the Bataclan. It's these kind of little poignant details that I think are revealing. And I think if there's anything in this novel in terms of any kind of truth or working through, it's done through pathos. It's done through the sad details. To come back to this idea of the catharsis, if there is a cathartic moment in this book, those kind of small, low-level, insignificant details that remain in your memory after you've lost a loved one, for example.
Yes, of course, catharsis probably, at least as we use it colloquially, is the wrong word, because it implies, as I said, at least colloquially, a kind of reckoning with something, getting it out of the way, getting it out of yourself, and then, you know, being able to continue. And of course, that's not the case for people whose lives have been touched by something like this.
I think it's worth remembering that Carré, you know, he was not touched directly by this case. He was a bemused, concerned observer when it was all happening. And there is a kind of a small micro genre of French writing that has emerged around the terrorist attacks of 2015. There was the Bataclan, and also earlier in the year, in January 2015, of course, there was the Charlie Hebdo shooting as well. And there is a genre of writing where survivors, I'm thinking of Philippe Lanson, who was shot in the Charlie Hebdo attack. There's also around the Bataclan, there's also been a number of memoirs that have been written by fathers or families of who've actually lost children, who've actually kind of got this direct relationship to the case, which is a very harrowing style of writing and a very harrowing read. But I think Carré has a certain amount of distance here, and he's able to tease out the moments. Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because it's not the first time he's been in that position either, because he wrote a book, didn't he, about the tsunami, because he was present but distant from that. He was staying not very far away, but not actually directly involved, and then wrote a book about that, didn't he?
He did that book about the tsunami. D'autres vies que la mienne, other lives than my own, is another kind of remarkably affecting collection of kind of portraits of people who have been through moments of incredible suffering or incredible sadness. It's an incredibly sad book. It's an incredibly pathetically moving book. And Carré as a writer, you know, he doesn't, you know, it's quite easy to cry when you're reading an Emmanuel Carré memoir. And he knows how to manipulate his readers. In the V13 book, there's a certain amount of restraint here. And I think part of that comes from the fact that this was, you know, this was serialized as newspaper columns. So he's probably being edited more closely than he might have been in previous work. But there's also a kind of, you know, there's also this distance, I think, too.
A natural restraint. Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, because sometimes you're calling it a novel and sometimes you're calling it a book, and it was a series of columns, but it's, where is it? What does it say on the front? Does it say it's a novel?
No, this is a collection of, this is a récit. This question of genre is really interesting, because, you know, Carré started off as a novelist writing pure fiction. He's moved into this non-fiction, but he still uses the tools of the novelist. You know, he doesn't play with the boundaries of fact and fiction as he does to great effect in something like Yoga, but he does play, you know, with narrative perspective and voices, and he creates memorable characters. But this is very squarely nonfiction.
There's none of the blurring of the genres that you might normally find with him.
Not here. Like, there's a great moment in Yoga when he creates a whole dramatic scene, and then at the end he kind of says, well, actually that didn't happen. And the reader kind of feels hoodwinked. There's none of that kind of literary cloak and daggers in this récit. And I think it would have been inappropriate for him to have kind of played it fast and loose with literature in quite that way here.
How are his columns, and how has this book been received in France?
Well, it's been received very well. You know, it's been, you know, Carré over the last 10 years has achieved a, you know, if not quite the status of a loved public intellectual, a kind of position of respect within the literary community and the reading community. He hasn't won any literary prizes. This is obviously the season of literary prizes, and he hasn't been crowned in that way. But, you know, this is a book that has sold. This is a book that has been critically regarded. It would just seem a little bit, to give it an award might seem a little bit kind of tacky. It seems to offer a little bit, it seems more of an important document than something that should be celebrated or crowned with a trophy or prize.
And also, as you said, that also might make it about him again.
Absolutely.
If they give him a prize for it, that. Yeah, and it sounds as though he and everyone else involved is trying quite hard not to do that. And as you say, it's unfortunately there's a kind of literary micro subgenre that now exists that can be identified. Russell, many thanks for guiding us through that very difficult book, and good luck in Indiana.
Yes, what will the day hold in store? I'm not quite sure yet.
Don't drink too much coffee.
Not too much coffee. Right. I know it's weak and watery, but I am worried about you getting the jitters. I may be projecting because I'm not good at limiting my own coffee intake. But I implore you not to do the same thing.
I'm going to try and track down a tenderloin sandwich at some point.
Splendid. Thank you very much, Russell. Still to come on the show, from Portuguese maritime history to insects to Bob Dylan, we chat through what our TLS contributors have been reading this year. And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
Back. I'm Alex Clark. Now it is that time of the year again. It might be that you open any newspaper and feel that all you are seeing is book recommendations. The books of the year of the great and the good of the literary world. Well, the TLS is no exception, but of course we would say that ours is the very best, the most surprising, the most capacious, and the most diverse. And here to talk us through it is the TLS's fiction editor, Toby Lichtig. Hello, Toby.
Hello.
What do you think of this topic? Do you look forward to this feature?
Well, as I don't have to put it together myself, and I can just approach it as a reader, yes, I do. I love it. I really look forward to it.
It is your wonderful colleague, David Horsepool, who does the legwork, doesn't he?
He does do all the work, yeah.
And I always note that he puts a very strong message telling people not to overwrite because they will be cut.
Yes, I think that there are some people who have been known to, submit their 1,500-word essay. And I think, I don't know, you tell me, Alex, because you're a contributor, what is the word limit, about 150 words, something like that?
I think it is something like that, yes.
And also recommending the book written by your wife, husband, brother, sister, mother, father, son, daughter, any of that is generally frowned upon, though that some of those do get in, don't they, under the
even
wire.
When you put the disclaimer in, it's frowned upon. I know she's my wife, and yes,
it's still a brilliant book.
I know that we've talked about this before, isn't it? This business of log rolling, it's very difficult to root out, isn't it? And yet it is something one doesn't want to encourage.
No, it devalues the business of criticism, doesn't it? You're supposed to be giving objective opinions, and you can't really do that when you're very, very close to someone. I mean, it can become difficult when you're commissioning, and in certain subject areas, people know each other. But yeah, we avoid log rolling at all costs. But I do love this feature for many reasons. I think lots of our readers love it for many reasons. And one is the vast breadth of reading one encounters, amongst these sort of 50 or 60 contributors across a vast array of fields. And also, I think some of the entries can just be beautiful little essays in their own right. They're great examples of just how one can, in this very, very particular form, be witty or irreverent or incisive. So yeah, I love it. And it's a big range of voices as well as choices, I would say.
Yes, I noted on the subject of wittiness, Sam Leith, who recommended Andrea Wolfe's Magnificent Rebels, which is about German romantics, ended his little thing with saying, "You'll love this book. It's like a TLS party."
Well, I noticed that bit as well, but can I read you the bit before that?
Mm.
It's a bit alarming. A bit of intellectual history, also a cauldron of fantastic gossip. Feuds, hero worshipped, doomed love, rampant adultery and stinky book reviews. It's all here. It'll remind you of a TLS party.
You see, I just thought he meant canapes and a lot of slightly vinegary white wine.
Yeah, I thought
he meant, but he meant adultery.
I don't remember all that for the last party, but clearly I left too early before all that started.
Well, we've got to that age, haven't we, Lucy? We make our excuses quite early and get home for CSI. That's how it goes.
But maybe we do. I love Joyce Carol Oates's because every year she just really does give you a list. I'm sure that's not all the books she's read because I'm sure she's read millions of books.
No, definitely not. She's probably written double the amount of books that she's listed.
Exactly.
Yeah, she almost certainly has.
It gives you a real insight into personality. So, you know, Sam Leith is kind of a bit playful. Joyce Carol Oates just gives you this wonderful dump of, you know, probably about 1% of her reading in this very sort
really
of straight down the
reading.
Line. Really interesting, yeah. Really diverse. You've got Michael Hoffman, who doesn't sort of miss the opportunity to be slightly snarky, but also shoot beautiful pieces of criticism. So he recommends Annie Ernaux's oeuvre and her entire oeuvre, particularly the years, and often it's been the year of Annie Ernaux with her Nobel win. But he says of her books, they give us a Coca-Cola bottle and ask us to infer our society in history and species from it, which is a brilliant way of explaining what Ernaux does. So it's a wonderful criticism in a sort of throwaway line. And then he says, he recommends Threshold, a poetry collection by Iman Mersal, which he says, you know, in parenthesis, it's the first new poems I've liked for years.
Brilliant. I hate poetry, but read this one.
Thereby, all these poets hoping that they might have got the Hoffman nod, just sitting there thinking, oh, not only did he not like my poetry, he hasn't liked any for years.
But, you know, how good must Mersal now feel to know that?
Now, I'm trying to remember now who it was who recommended Sheila Hetty's Pure Colour, because I thought, oh, thank goodness, because not everybody liked that book, but I really, really liked it. Toby, I can't remember where you stood on it.
I haven't read it, so can't really opine. I like Sheila Hetty. I really liked How Should a Person Be? Although I wonder now if I revisited it 10 years on what I would feel. But yeah.
I'm frantically leafing through as you speak, trying to find out who it was that recommended
it. It was Claire Carlisle, in fact. And I think one of the things that people found tricky about this book is there are kind of passages where, you know, the narrator curls up and becomes part of a leaf. I mean, that's.
But that sounds completely fascinating.
The level of narrative caprice we're talking about. But it's about grief at parental loss. And I just found it one of the best explanations, I suppose, of that I've ever read. So I thought it was marvelous, and I'm glad. And now you see, I treat these essays as a sort of vindication of my own tastes, as well as a sort of shopping expedition for things to read.
Well, you go, yes, good, I was right.
I was absolutely right. Claire Carlisle thinks so, and so do I.
Yeah. Can I read Ian Sansom? It's absolutely brilliant. One of the very nice things about this is that it is all positive, because people are saying what they liked, what they found interesting and fascinating, and, you know, all of that. So nobody's kind of knifing each other in the ribs very much. And that's not what Ian Sansom is doing, but it's a slightly different tone. He opens with a quote from Philip Larkin, who, as we know, was a right laugh generally. He says, "What an awful time of year this is. Just as one is feeling that if one can just hold on, it won't get any worse, then all this Christmas idiocy bursts upon one like a slavering Niagara of nonsense and completely wrecks one's entire frame." And then Ian Sansom says, "Nothing changes." And he recommends a book called Silent Earth, Averting the Insect Apocalypse, which actually I do want to read, but he does say, this is not Uplift. You know, it's an important book, but it's not Uplift. The book that he does recommend for Uplift is called Everybody Has a Plan Until They Get Punched in the Face, which is a brilliant title. It's
the
about boxing.
By Tony Bellew, who is a boxer, was a boxer. Yeah. And it's a kind of really fascinating on boxing and, you know, boxing and the individual.
And Sanson says very gnomically and brilliantly, he says, it's a book about boxing, but, you know, it applies. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. Yes, he also points out, and this is all within 150 words, listeners. I am well aware, says Ian Sampson, that the grass withereth and the flower fadeth. Which is that the kind of thing we want to be reading to cheer ourselves up as we have to go into the kind of fray of Christmas?
I don't think that's what you're saying. I don't think the book about the insect apocalypse is going to cheer you up. The book about getting punched in the face is, apparently. But the other one is important anyway.
It's quite a bit of Dylan, isn't there, in these recommendations? Quite a lot of people are liking Bob Dylan's The Philosophy of Modern Song, Wesley Stace, and Elaine Showalter is also recommending a book about Dylan by Graham Marcus. I mean, there have been an awful lot of music biographies this year, haven't there? I mean, thinking about Bono, for example, but all sorts of people getting clearly to that time of their career and their life, I suppose, where they are looking back. Do you have any favourites?
I haven't read any of those books. Paul Muldoon recommended Bono's book, which I think is only just out. There are a lot of them around. I feel sometimes like maybe it's good if musicians play music. Is that grumpy of me?
A little grumpy. I mean, actually, and Wesley Stace is actually someone who, you know, does the crossover very well, doesn't he? He plays music and he writes very nicely. And I think musicians are allowed to write as well.
I mean, Dylan does write. He's a Nobel Prize winner. Yes, exactly.
I know.
I think I perhaps like Dylan more than Lucy does, perhaps.
I just prefer it. I also find it very difficult reading about Dylan because people do go on, don't they, a bit?
I think I might be one of the goers on us.
Oh, really?
Unfortunately, so I'm going quiet.
No, don't go quiet. That's just me being grumpy.
Let's get on to Roger Federer. I'm getting on to the sunnier uplands of Roger Federer. Also recommended, in fact, again, I think Joyce Carol Oates just recommended everything, hasn't she, really? Even within her 150 words. But Elaine Showalter recommends Jeff Dyer's book about Federer, The Last Days. And it's sort of wider meditation on the idea of things coming to an end.
Yes, late style.
Late style, I see.
Interested in. And because it's Jeff Dyer, it's also about everything. So he sort of moves from one topic to the other in his wonderful Jeff Dyerish voice. I read this earlier this year and I loved it, actually. I thought it was brilliant. So yeah, good recommendation.
It's not sunlit uplands, though. Well, it's managing graceful decline.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, the sun setting downlands, perhaps, lowlands.
Yes. And actually, one of the things I took from it really strongly, which is possibly a ridiculous thing to take from it, is that we must all do lots of Pilates. Do you remember there's one bit in it? Because he talks about the injuries he's had from playing tennis. He goes, his back and his knees and his ankles and his arms and all of that. And he just says, there are people who don't get these injuries and they've all done loads of Pilates. So that for me was, Jeff Dyer saying, do loads of Pilates and you'll be all right.
He is a very healthy individual, though. I think he does really look after himself, doesn't he?
Well, he obviously plays a lot of tennis, which counts.
I'm talking about Jeff Dyer, not Roger Federer.
Yes. Jeff Dyer also plays a lot of tennis. Yeah, he does too. Yeah. Roger Federer looks after himself.
Is really this the place to tell you my Jeff Dyer poached egg story?
Yes.
I think so, yes.
Well, I met him, our paths have crossed a little bit this year because he's been at festivals talking about this book. And they crossed in West Cork, where there was a very jolly breakfast meeting of people who'd been at the festival. And I came down very slightly after other people and they'd all had an egg. And Jeff Dyer was insistent that it was very important to specify exactly the time that one's egg should be poached. And I, being a sort of slight kind of, I don't know, people pleaser and anxious in this rather busy restaurant, did not do that. And I got a slightly hard poached egg. And Jeff Dyer now has seen me for several times and said, how are the poached eggs going? Have you learnt your lesson, basically? So he is very exacting and he is the man to sit with at breakfast if you want to specify exactly how you would like the consistency of your egg yolk.
Okay, well, that's very good to know. Well, we had Jeff Dyer on the podcast a while ago. Maybe it was last year. Maybe it was the year before. I'm doing that thing of saying, was it 10 years ago? I can't remember. Because he was talking about Lonesome Dove, which he wrote about in the TLS. And then I read because he wrote the piece. And then we just, if you've read Lonesome Dove, especially if you've just read it, you just want to talk about it a lot in depth with someone else who's read it. And that's what we did. There's a particularly horrible bit, which if you don't like snakes, you should almost read, you know, between your fingers. But it's totally brilliant. I'm so grateful to him for saying, you know, I read this huge Western and found it absolutely wonderful. And then I did the same thing. So there's a bit of positivity for you.
It's a podcast worth looking up for listeners who haven't listened to it. And the piece itself, which I believe it's one of the longest pieces we've published in the last 5 years, I think it's about 7,000 or 8,000 words.
Yeah, and I could have had it double the length. You know?
Yeah, exactly. For those who subscribe, you can find it in the archive. You look up Lonesome Dove. It's a really, really brilliant piece.
And you don't have to be remotely interested in Westerns or anything like that to read the book. It's not...
Look, I'm going to do it. I'm coming in as the ignoramus to say, what is Lonesome Dove? Who is it by?
It's by Larry McMurtry.
Surely not every listener will know, like me. And I know I should know.
I'm sorry.
By Larry McMurtry. I got a bit mixed up there and couldn't think who it was by. Toby, you're the fiction editor here. How bad is it if you mix up Larry McMurtry and Cormac McCarthy?
I think it's fine.
Depends if they're there or not.
They are different.
At a TLS party, as described by Sam Leith, dreadful. But just in front of our listeners and you two, it's okay. All right, fine.
They both, as well as, you know, having Mook in their surname and, you know, sounding very Vegas, they both write Westerns, don't they? Different sorts of styles of Westerns. But yeah, you know, there are crossovers. But anyway, I think we shouldn't mix them up if we can.
No, they are very different people. What would you take from the books of the year? Do you know what I mean? Which ones have you read about and thought, oh, I must read that?
It depends whether I'm playing Alex's game of saying, oh, yes, I've read that and I completely agree, or, oh, I've been meaning to read that. Because the main book that I have been meaning to read, not so much that I've been meaning and failing, I've just been saving it, is the Joseph Roth biography, which came out quite recently, a few weeks ago.
It's recommended by William Boyd here, isn't it?
Exactly, recommended by William Boyd. We ran a really brilliant piece on it by George Proshnett. And it's called Endless Flight, The Life of Joseph Roth. It's by Kieran Pym. And as Boyd points out, although amazingly, the whole of Roth's corpus has been translated into English now, most of it this century, much of it by the wonderful Michael Hoffman, the wonderful aforementioned Michael Hoffman. There hasn't really been a major biography in English ever. And now that is not the case anymore because this wonderful book's come out and it just sounds so brilliant and his life is so interesting and sad. And I just am very keen to read it.
What did he say? William Boyd said it supplies all the information on Roth's tormented, rootless, inebriated life.
Yes. He did and achieved an awful lot. He died in his early 40s. He did drink an awful lot. He looked a lot older than he was. Even, you know, when he was in his early 30s, he looked about 50. It was partly the drink, I think. And, you know, he lived in this incredibly tumultuous period in, you know, the interwar years in Germany and across Central Europe, and reported on First World War and its aftermath and Germany in the 20s. And yeah, he died tragically young, and it sounds really, really fascinating, this book. So that is my little Christmas treat.
Mm. What about you, Alex? Is your Christmas treat not having to read a book for a week? No, let's not say that on a books podcast.
Absolutely not. But I am going to start with the admission of something that I haven't read. Actually, a writer that I haven't read. And Paul Griffiths recommends John Foss. And John Foss is not a writer I've read. Have either of you two?
I have, because Toby commissioned me. Didn't you, Toby? Yes.
I
read three of them, at least three, actually. And I've seen one of his plays. It's very moving. It's very moving. I imagine this one will be. In fact, I was struck by this one because the woman is a central character, whereas all the ones I read, it was a male central character.
I think it narrates a story that he's told before from the point of view of a man, this woman's husband, and it's now from the point of view of the woman, which is a very John Foss thing to do. He sort of retells stories,
yeah,
either at different points in the same person's life or from different points of view. He's very into kind of reworking the same material. I suppose, you know, maybe a bit a la Patrick Modiano, for example, where it's similar scenes just through slightly different lenses.
It's called Alice at the Fire, isn't it, the new one?
That's right.
Just a pause to say, goodness me, what a year for Fitzcarraldo. It's published by Fitzcarraldo, who also published Annie Ernaux, and I think the winners of the Goldsmith Prize.
And Thea-Lena Dudsey, let's not forget.
And Thea-Lena Dudsey, I mean...
And Olga Tokarczuk, another Nobel Prize winner. And actually, John Foss, it would not be surprising if he won the Nobel in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and he's often talked
about. No, not at all. Yeah.
So I suspect we will all be hearing a lot more about him.
Well, that is what I'm going to try to correct my ignorance of John Foss. And also going with a recommendation by Paul Muldoon, a book that I really wish I'd had time to read, but haven't yet. Catherine Rundle's Super Infinite, The Transformations of John Donne, because, well, I love Donne, which is, I've got a kind of proper fondness and gratitude for him because he's sort of, well, he kind of upped my score in the old finals, 30 years ago. He was my best paper. That was my best paper, that one. It's my specialist subject. So
very good. Well, Chris, you want it later. Specialist subject, don't go that far. No, all right. I've been meaning to read that one as well. I feel like everyone's read it and I haven't read it. I feel,
Any consolation, I haven't read it. Although I think Catherine Rundle is brilliant. And I've actually read a couple of her children's books.
Yes, so have I.
Yes, so have I.
Two or three. Yes.
Oh, there you go.
You've got a reading age of 12.
Debbie, do you know especially why we've done this? Because back in the days of the Costa Prize, we used to natter on about the Costa Prize on the radio, didn't we? And
we
she
did.
Was so often in the running for the Children's Prize. And I'm sure this must be why I've read her.
Exactly. No, I think, there was one that was set in the Amazon or in South America.
Yes.
Yeah, we definitely talked about that one, didn't we, Alex? She's a fascinating character.
Look, we've sparked into life while talking about children's books in the Amazon.
But as well as being a medievalist and a children's author, she's also, Catherine Rundle, she also does night walking across the spires of Oxford. I think she wrote a book about that as well. But yeah, rooftopping, I believe it's called. Yeah.
Well, she's got a book called Rooftoppers as well. I think she's like a climber.
She's a climber, so she climbs up the roof of a building.
Ridiculous.
Yes, she does.
She doesn't exist. She's one of these
made-up
people.
She's like a superwoman.
She does. I've seen her give a talk. She gave an absolutely brilliant lecture on the climbing, on the rooftopping.
And is this kind of, she goes up with sort of, ropes, etc. And is this also kind of not allowed? Is it trespassing as well?
I think it's a bit naughty, but, you know, I'm sure it's done safely. I think it's fine.
Wow, that is amazing. And thank you for bringing us so much more knowledge about Catherine Rundle, who is the kind of superwoman, clearly. Right, we are nearly out of time, lads, and I'm going to ask you for your recommendations for what people should read this Christmas.
We've talked a bit before when I've come on the podcast about Claire Keegan, whose wonderful novel, Small Things Like These, was shortlisted for the Booker this year. And I, on the back of that, was sent to another Claire Keegan novel recently called Foster, which was reviewed, which is utterly brilliant as well. I read that a couple of weeks ago. It is so beautiful.
And it's a kind of really an extended short story in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, a bit like Small Things Like These. She writes these very short, I mean, they're not even short novels, they're short novellas. I think I talked about this before as well, when Damon Galgut reviewed Small Things Like These, he said in his piece that her technique is to write a sentence over and over and over and over and over again until it's perfect and then move on and never revise after that. So, and you really get that sense, because it is everything's so perfectly weighted. But Foster's this...
And all about, as she says, I interviewed her over the summer... Taking things away. That's what she does. She takes things away.
Yes, that completely makes sense. It's all so pared down, and yet it does so much. It's extraordinary. Foster's this story of this young girl who's sort of in the mid-80s in rural Ireland, who's taken in by this slightly wealthier family. They're not particularly wealthy, but they're wealthier than this girl's very poor family over the summer at a period when this girl's mother's had another baby. And it's about the relationship she develops with this foster couple. And then she has to return home and she doesn't really want to. And it's very, very beautiful and very moving. But they're great Christmas presents because they're not just brilliant. They're very short. And, it's not that I always want to recommend very short books just for the sake of it. But sometimes giving people books as gifts can be a little bit of a poison chalice. You give someone an 800 page tome and say, I loved this, and they sort of feel duty bound to read it. But I think short books make good presents. And these are brilliant.
That's a brilliant. So I'm surely we can get that going as the new kind of keep calm and carry on. Retire on the proceeds of the merch, surely, Toby. Lucy, what about you?
Can I just cheat and not do the thing that you want me to do? I want to recommend something else that I haven't read.
I've got no power over you, as we know.
I'm just going to do it then. Richard Davenport Hines recommends Ed Yong's An Immense World, which he says, it just sounds absolutely wonderful. And I've been sort of hearing about it all year and meaning to read it. He says it's an account of the astounding variety of perceptions of mammals, birds, reptiles, insects and fish, their copious innate powers, and it left him awed and stunned. So I actually want to read that. So I'm encouraging everyone to read that, even though I haven't. It sounds wonderful. I read his earlier book, which was called something like The Infinite Multitudes, which was fascinating as well.
And his journalism is fantastic, yeah, isn't it? I mean, he is an amazing writer.
And it's one of those rare things where you kind of feel like a kid again. You kind of think, coo, wow, you know, I didn't know fish could do that, or bats or whatever it is. It sort of brings a sense of wonder, which is rare enough occurrence that I think it's worth chasing.
And you might actually feel like you're learning something, which is what we always like in a book, isn't it?
Yes, though, can I say it's not rare that I learn things. I'm always learning things. I know nothing. What about you, Alex? What are you recommending?
Do you know what? I'm absolutely surrounded by crows where I live. Or rooks, as Max Porter once said to me. If there's a lot of them, they're rooks. And so I actually ordered a copy of Esther Wolfson's Corvus, which is like years old. But I thought, I actually don't know anything about these birds. But that's a by the by. I am going to recommend a book that I've just read and that has only just come out. I don't know if either of you have started it or are going to read it. Jonathan Coe's Bourneville, which I thought was just magnificent. I absolutely loved it. There we are. There you have it. Bourneville.
Bourneville is the name of the new novel. We should say yes, Bourneville.
Yes, you're not just saying words of chocolate. The chocolate's involved, isn't it?
Chocolate's very much involved.
Well, that's a brilliant thing to read at Christmas. We should probably wrap it up, shouldn't we? We've told people enough about what they should read now. Everyone's staggering under teetering piles of books.
They really are. And they've not even got to the quality street yet. What a range of stuff to enjoy. Thank you to all the contributors to this year's Books of the Year. Thank you so much for being our guide through them, Toby. And obviously it is now heads down for next year's titles.
Can't wait.
You must be very busy.
Oh, I am. Oh, yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Toby Lischtig and Russell Williams.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardy.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.